Let's face it, a jury summons is not the most welcomed piece of mail. But in this economy, it's even less welcome than before. Across the country, more and more people are telling court officials that financial hardship should keep them out of the jury box. Here's reporter Gloria Hillard.
It's 7:30 in the morning at the Los Angeles Superior Court Criminal Justice Center.
Those of you that are here for jury duty, can I please ask you to form two lines?
Jury summons in hand, they file into the jury assembly room. Jury orientation generally includes a judge's welcome, and today it's from Superior Court Judge Marcelita Haynes.
Good morning.
Judge Haynes reminds the jurors how important they are, and then gets to the subject on the minds of many.
The other thing I want to tell you is that we understand the economy, we understand what's going on.
On the 15th floor of Juror Services, Patricia Powell hears firsthand what's going on every day. She says people asking to be excused or to postpone their jury service is nothing new, but these days, the stories are more personal.
They've been unemployed for quite some time, that they're self-employed due to losing a job. They're losing their homes. You get a lot of jurors who are crying.
No one is keeping national statistics on how hardship excuses are affecting courts. But to get a sense of the problem, the Center for Jury Studies, which provides assistance to state courts on jury trial management, conducted an informal poll of jury administrators earlier this year. Responses varied. Some locales said it wasn't a problem. Others, like one county in Nevada, said they were hearing more desperation in the voices and letters of potential jurors. Director Paula Hannaford-Agor says the impact on juries depends on how hard the recession has hit a given community, how long courts require citizens to serve, and the actual jury fee.
The national average, I think, is $22 a day, but there are still a number of states where the payment is $10 a day. That's certainly adding insult to injury with people who are certainly feeling emotionally frazzled by the economic situation now.
At King County Superior Court in Seattle, jurors get paid $10 a day. Jury Services Manager Greg Wheeler.
More and more now, we're hearing from individuals that even 2 days, even one day, is going to be a hardship for them, that they're not able to handle that financially in any way.
B0838 here. B9323
here.
In the hallway of L.A. Superior Court Criminal Justice Center, a small crowd of newly impaneled jurors are waiting to be called into the courtroom. Once inside, anyone with an extreme financial hardship has the opportunity to address the judge about their situation.
The court really strives to make sure that we carefully look at each individual's situation, and all the judges do.
Superior Court Judge Patricia Schnegg is Assistant Supervising Judge for L.A. County's Criminal Court. She says most judges will allow jurors having a tough time to postpone their service.
We'll excuse them for a year. And most of these people really do want to do jury duty. A lot of them are people who have served in the past but have lost their jobs and they just can't cope right now.
Judges and jury administrators aren't the only ones dealing with the issue.
As a trial attorney, you never want people on your jury that don't want to be there.
Criminal defense lawyer David S. Kestenbaum says in recent months, the issue has caused both prosecuting and defense attorneys in L.A. County to stipulate that a juror be removed when a judge has already denied their financial hardship excuse.
We've had to, because especially in serious long cases, you want people that are paying attention to the testimony and the evidence presented in court, not feeling that they really need to provide for their family and would like to be somewhere else.
Those in the court system know these challenges are likely to remain as long as the economy is weak. But with trial by jury still the centerpiece of the American justice system, the acknowledgement given to jurors these days has special resonance.
We still have to continue. We still have to do our job and process cases that come before us. Please, please help us do that. We want to thank you once again for taking the time.
For NPR News, I'm Gloria Hillard.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Yesterday, the investment bank Goldman Sachs announced its third quarter profits, a whopping $3.2 billion. Commentator and economist Russ Roberts is not impressed.
Should we care about Goldman's profits and compensation? It's pretty gauche when your take-home pay is millions of dollars while some of your neighbors can't find work. But is it wrong? Is it something those of us on the outside should care about? Normally, I'd say it's nobody's business. What people get paid is best left to the marketplace. But Goldman Sachs is different because those of us on the outside are really on the inside. Goldman Sachs was propped up with our money, not the money they took directly from the government and paid back, the money that AIG gave them that really came from the taxpayer. Goldman Sachs being proud of their performance this year is like the Harlem Globetrotters bragging that they went undefeated. It's not really a normal competition. Goldman Sachs played the same game as Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers. They made lousy investments financed with borrowed money. When the assets fell in value, Bear and Lehman died. They were reckless with other people's money. But Goldman Sachs is still here. Why? Part of the reason is that maybe they took a little less risk and maybe hedged against that risk a little better. But part of the reason Goldman lives and thrives is that the government bailed out AIG. Almost $13 billion of the money the government sent to AIG went out the door and over to Goldman. This money included loans and insurance Goldman bought on its bad bets. Some of that insurance turned out to be a bad bet, too, but Goldman didn't bear the cost. The taxpayers did. Part of the reason Goldman and other Wall Street firms made so many bad bets is they knew they might be rescued. And most of the time, they were. The rescue of large financial institutions is justified by policymakers as a way to save the system and protect Main Street from a tsunami of financial instability. But capitalism is a profit and loss system. The profits encourage risk-taking. The losses encourage prudence. If the taxpayer almost always eats the losses for the losers, you don't have capitalism. You have crony capitalism. The latest rescue of Wall Street has taken hundreds of billions of dollars from average Americans and given that money to some of the richest people in human history, people who made bad bets and should have taken enormous losses. Instead, they've been taken care of. Their triumph makes Bernie Madoff look like a small-time operator. The key policymakers, Hank Paulson, Ben Bernanke, and Tim Geithner, have been praised for keeping things afloat. But to what purpose? What's the virtue of saving crony capitalism? Maybe they prevented an even worse recession. There's no way of knowing. But they have deeply damaged both capitalism and democracy. We have a financial system that not only rewards cronies and encourages recklessness, it also funnels precious capital into areas like the housing sector instead of into more productive investments. We have to stop rescuing the reckless. We have to let people who make bad decisions bear the consequences. Profit and loss. The rest of us live that way. Wall Street can too.
Russ Roberts is a professor of economics at George Mason University. He's also a research scholar at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. To comment on this essay, go to the opinion section of NPR.org.
And in southern Oregon, the local economy is a bit more brisk. That's because when temperatures start to drop, migrant workers head to the wooded region along the California border to pick mushrooms. It's not an easy job, and this year it's even tougher, as Ethan Lindsay of Oregon Public Radio reports.
This national forest land in Oregon may very well be the mushroom capital of the world between September and November.
My name's Sam Lee. The mushrooms are not too many.
Sam Lee is Laotian American. He's chasing matsutake mushrooms, but says this year there aren't that many. Matsis, as they're called, are a prized delicacy in Japan. At one point in the 90s, they fetched $750 per pound on the international market. They're closer to $25 a pound these days. But pickers like Lee say if you can find a lot of them, that price is still good enough to make money. Lee lives in Fresno, California for most of the year, but he's come to Oregon every fall since 1986. And he's not the only one.
I primarily have mung in the back, and I have mien over there. On this end, there's Lau.
Gidget Flanagan runs a small roadside motel in the town of Chumult. These days, she's the unofficial mayor, sheriff, and innkeeper for more than 100 people camping on her property.
Everybody is out in the woods gathering. In about 5 hours, it's going to be bustling people getting ready for their dinner, and then you're going to smell all the foods, and that's amazing. It's incredible at night, actually. A breathing community that just doesn't stop.
At night, the south side of town around Flanagan's Inn grows into a combination campsite, shantytown, and outdoor mushroom market. Most everyone is of Southeast Asian ancestry, or harvesting the forest as part of traditional culture.
Many of them will follow the matsutake specifically, like migrant workers. You know, they'll do huckleberries, they'll do chanterelles, they'll do morels, they'll do matsutakes. And then after matsutakes, they'll go and they'll do something else. They see it as a job. It's just a job.
But the economy has changed things this year. Cece Headley is with the Eugene-based Alliance of Forest Workers and Harvesters. They're a mostly volunteer group that provides language interpretation and other services to the pickers.
There are probably more younger Southeast Asians coming and more new first-time pickers, a lot more first-time pickers, you know, who would normally have another job. Mostly it's poor people, and poor people are having a really hard time. It's a really, really, it's always hard to be poor, but right now is really difficult.
I've never seen so many people and so many inexperienced people.
Enrique Santos is a forest monitor with the Alliance. He was brought in to work with Spanish speakers who are showing up in greater numbers than ever. He says inexperienced workers don't get much help from the old hands who try to keep the best mushroom fields to themselves. For instance, Santos worked with one family of 10 migrant workers that came down from Washington this year for the first time.
They ended up spending $1,000, and they were only making like $1 a day per person.
Good pickers are making some money, but they say the weather this year started out too dry to produce top-rate mushrooms. But the harvesting community still has to buy gas, food, and on a good day in the forest, beer, and all that money stays here in Oregon, where the locals certainly need it. For NPR News, I'm Ethan Lindsay.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce has made no secret of its opposition to climate change legislation working its way through Congress. So when the chamber held a news conference this morning announcing a complete reversal, it was big news. But only for about 20 minutes until it became clear that the whole thing was a hoax. NPR's Tamara Keith tells us what happened.
The Chamber of Commerce got punked, and so did Reuters, which went to its newswire with urgent bulletins announcing the chamber's apparent shift. There was a press release, an official-looking website, and a news conference at the National Press Club with this guy behind the podium.
I am Hingo Sembra, official spokesperson for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
Okay, so what's your real name?
Okay, I'm Andy Bickelbaum, and I'm with the Yes Men.
The Yes Men are a crew of pranksters who have pulled off similar hoaxes, posing as officials from Exxon, Halliburton, and the federal government. In this case, they were working with a small activist group called the Climate Action Factory. Bickelbaum wore a borrowed black suit. He delivered formal remarks about the chamber's momentous decision, then opened it up to questions. There were about a dozen reporters there.
The questions seemed to all be very banal, like, well, this carbon tax you're talking about, it's not necessarily going to happen. How do you feel about that? You know, what are the next steps? It just seemed perfectly ordinary to everybody.
Perfectly ordinary until a real chamber spokesman showed up.
I'm Eric Wolfschlegel. I'm with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. This is not an official U.S. Chamber of Commerce event.
In this video, shot by Brandon Jordan and posted on the Yes Men website, the real chamber spokesman and the fake chamber spokesman argue about who's lying.
Can I see your business card?
Can I see yours?
Are you here representing?
The audio is hard to understand, but basically Wolfschlegel is challenging Bickelbaum's credentials, saying it's strange he's never seen him around the chamber before. Now, just to be clear, the chamber has not changed its position on climate change legislation. It says it supports the idea of addressing climate change, just not the bills Congress has come up with. In a statement, the business lobbying group said hoaxes like this one undermine genuine efforts to address climate change. 20 minutes after the first breathless bulletin, Reuters issued a correction. Courtney Dolan with Thomson Reuters says the news service has an obligation to run with stories that could move the financial markets.
Once we confirmed the release was a hoax, we immediately issued a correction. And in keeping with the Reuters policy, the story was subsequently withdrawn and an advisory was sent to readers.
The chamber says it will be asking law enforcement authorities to investigate the hoax. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.